A Biblical Theory of Sexual Intimacy, the eighth talk in a series titled Understanding Love, Sex, and Marriage, was presented by Jack Crabtree on November 19, 2002, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
For the first several weeks, and we are going to now shift and begin for a few weeks to focus on sexuality as such. And we're going to begin that with a look at what I'm calling a theory of sexual intimacy. Let me review just briefly, in order to understand a biblical perspective on sexual intimacy, I think we have to review briefly a biblical theory of marriage. We looked at that a number of weeks ago. And I suggested that there are really basically two components to the marriage commitment. First of all, I suggested that marriage is a commitment. It's a duty, an obligation, a commitment to which we are morally obligated that we take on in relationship, a man to a woman. And the commitment, the nature of that commitment is twofold. One, that we're committing ourselves to enter into a relationship where we grant a unique loyalty to one another. I will keep that person as special, unique in my life. No one else holds a higher place. I will reserve the most intimate knowledge of myself to give to my partner, to my marriage partner, and no one else will I treat with the same level of specialness as this person. I'm committing myself to that. And then we're committing ourselves to this thing that the Bible calls becoming one flesh. A complete giving and sharing of myself so that all that I am and all that I have, I give to my spouse. Those two things, the special place, the unique loyalty, and the unity, the complete merging of our lives in our own perspective toward one another, where everything that we have, we share together. That's the nature of the marriage relationship. I also, by way of review, suggested, I think in the first week, that from a biblical perspective, the priority is just exactly the reverse from what modern anthropology would tell us. In modern anthropology, the given, the fixed point, is the fact that we are sexual beings. And marriage is simply a human invention, a human device for channeling and managing our sexuality. From a biblical perspective, it's exactly the reverse. The given is that we were made to be married. As human beings, as man and woman were made to be married to one another, and God has so designed sexuality to be a tool that God has given to facilitate marriage somehow, and that's what we want to explore tonight, is exactly how that works. So, one of the implications of that is that in the modern anthropological approach, we as sexual beings, we are basically animals. Human beings are a distinctive form of animal, with animal drives, and we have these, we're clever enough to invent these institutions to help us manage our animal drives. So, in their perspective, human sexuality is not really qualitatively different from animal sexuality. From a biblical perspective, that's not the case. Human sexuality is an entirely different phenomenon. It's an entirely different thing from animal sexuality. And to confuse that is to be very confused about ourselves. So that's by way of review. Given that, then what is the biblical view of sexual intimacy? Now I'm going to use the word sexual intimacy. Let me define it. By sexual intimacy, I mean anything. What do I mean? Where that becomes an important question is When we are young and we're first trying to come to terms with the ethics of sexuality, that there are certain things that you can and can't do, certain things that are out of bounds, other things that are not out of bounds, and we ask the question, well, what can I do? that as I have these desires for erotic behavior, I have these desires for sexual expression, but I have this church or this culture telling me, no, you can't do that if you're not married. And the question that we raise is, well, what can't I do exactly? Where are you drawing the line between what I can do and what I can't do if I'm not married to one, to the other person? That's where the question comes up, is we have to define, when does a behavior, when is it sexual? When is it something that becomes subject to ethical boundaries and ethical restraints? When is it just innocent and not a problem? I can't define that boundary. I don't know anyone who can define that boundary, but I know that boundary. And you know that boundary also. It's really not a mystery when we have stepped over that line, when our behavior has become sexual. It's really not all that mysterious. We know when it has happened. But it's one of those things in life that when you actually try to analyze it and articulate it and define it, it escapes analysis. It escapes definition. So for me, it boils down to a very simple rule of thumb. If the behavior is such that I walked in the room and saw my daughter engaging in it with a male that I didn't know or was not her husband, how would I respond? How would I react? Would I react with a sense of the inappropriateness and the outrage of it? To apply the same test, if my wife were to be engaged in that activity with someone else other than me, would I have a sense of the inappropriateness of it? Would I be outraged by it? If my sister were engaged in that activity with a man that she was not married to, would I have a sense of the inappropriateness of it? Now, is that rule of thumb subject to distortion? Well, sure, probably. But for the most part, our sensibilities in that regard are pretty accurate. We don't really have a problem with that. We may rationalize our activity, our behavior, but there's no question when we've stepped over that line and behavior or activity has become sexual. So, in the end, sexual intimacy can span a fairly large, it takes in a fairly large scope of activity. It can be only verbal. Sexual activity can be simply words or simply looks exchanged, and that can be sexual. It can be sexually intimate in a way that's actually inappropriate. I'm sort of getting ahead of myself, but just to illustrate that point, I remember years and years and years ago, back in the days when it was sort of more or less safe to hitchhike, or at least we thought it was, I was hitchhiking from Oregon to San Francisco, and I got picked up by what must have been weathermen, looking back on it, the radical political New Left group that bombed buildings and stuff like that. And I think I was, well, it was this old station wagon where the back had been built up and a mattress put on it, and all you had for seats was the front seat. And there was a man and two women in the front seat. So I was glad to get a ride, and they put me back on the mattress in the back, which was kind of weird. But I think I was lying on a bunch of weapons, probably. It was either drugs or weapons, I'm not sure. But I fell asleep. And I remember, so it was late at night, one of the other women was asleep in the front seat, and I was asleep on the mattress in the back. And I woke up to this conversation that was going on between one of the other women and the man who was driving the car. And it was about this woman's exploits as a prostitute for the revolution. She would evidently prostitute herself to wealthy Seattle businessmen to make a bunch of money to buy stuff for the revolution. But the banter back and forth, the conversation back and forth, was about fairly intimate sexual details of their lives and her experience and her escapades as a prostitute. Well, it wasn't long till they stopped, kicked me out of the back seat, put me up in the front seat, had the other woman drive, and they proceeded to practice what what they had been talking about. But what was striking about that whole thing is the sex had begun long before they were in the back. The talk back and forth was full of sexual energy between the two of them already. So they were already being sexually involved with one another just with words. And the same can be true of looks. There's all kinds of ways that we can convey my sexual interest, the sexual energy, that I can convey my willingness to be yours, to give myself to you. Now, what's so striking about that is one could talk about the same subject matter in a different kind of way. One can expose their nude body to someone in a way that's not sexual. Someone can... So that's what makes it so difficult to define, is you can't say, well, nudity is always wrong, or talking about sex is always wrong, is always inappropriate, or this or that. Anytime you try to define it in those terms, you can think of counterexamples. You can think of a way of talking about it, or a way of having your naked body exposed, or something like that, that is not really sexual in nature. But more often than not, we don't need it defined for us. We know it when it happens. We see it, we observe it, we feel it, we experience it, we intuitively recognize it as being a sexual relationship or a sexual encounter, a sexually intimate experience. So I'm not going to define it. I don't think I need to define it. But in broad strokes, it can be anything from what we say to one another, to the look that we give to one another, to the touch that we have, whatever, down all the way down to full-blown sexual intercourse. All that I mean roughly by sexual intimacy. Now, having said that, I'm going to concentrate on actual sexual intercourse and the touching and the sharing of bodies that goes with that. That's primarily what I'm going to be talking about tonight. But I just want to be clear that I don't rule out other non-physical aspects of sexual intimacy at the same time. My contention is that the only way we can make sense out of what the Bible teaches, what biblical sexual ethics is, and there's one passage in particular that I think there's only one way to understand that passage, is to suggest that from a biblical point of view, sexual intimacy is a kind of natural language. Now, let me explain what I mean by a natural language. I'm getting that. I've been helped here, at least in articulating this, by a Scottish common sense philosopher named Thomas Reid, who argued in an entirely different context that our sense experience is a sort of natural language. And what he means by that is, you know, when I rub my fingertips across the top of this book and I notice that it's smooth. But he says, let's stop for a second. What is the actual sensation in my fingertips as I do this? Well, I've come to call it smooth, but the actual sensation is an entirely different kind of sensation from smoothness. I have just come to recognize the meaning of this sensation in my fingertips. If I smell a rose, there's a very distinctive fragrance that I experience as a part of my sense experience, that aroma, that rose fragrance. I call it a rose, but the fragrance bears no relationship to the object, the flower. It doesn't bear any more relationship to the flower than the word G-O-L-D does to that metallic ore. I just have come to associate the word gold with the ore that you dig out of the ground. I've come to associate that sensation, that fragrance that I experience sensually with that flower, the presence of that flower, and right on down the line. That my sense experience, my ability to have sensory experience, gives the world that God created the ability to speak to me, to tell me about itself, to inform me of its presence and of its reality and of its structure to a certain extent. And it speaks to me through the language of my senses. Now, what was significant is Thomas Reed argues that that's what he calls a natural language as opposed to an artificial language. An artificial language is a language like English or German or French or whatever, some language that we men have basically by convention devised to speak to one another. But the natural language is a language where we as human beings are already, it's already built into us to either know or learn the meaning of that language. And that language is universal among human beings. Every human being knows that language and understands that language the same way. This book is just as smooth halfway around the world as it is here. And this sensation is recognizable as the smoothness of the book here in Eugene as it is in Afghanistan. So that it's a universal language. I'm borrowing that idea from Thomas Reed, therefore, to talk about sexual intimacy. There's some important differences between what he's talking about and sexuality, but I just want to explain where the language is coming from. My argument would be that universal among human beings and built into us as human beings intuitively and instinctively is an understanding of the meaning of sexual intimacy. That is, God has so constructed human sexuality that sexual intimacy has an inherent meaning to it, and we as human beings instinctively know what it means. We don't need to be taught, we don't need to be informed, we don't need to be persuaded, we just know. We know what it means when someone has been sexually intimate with me. Basically, what it comes down to, I think, is that we have this sense built into our psyche that builds an identification between myself and my body. My body is me and I am my body. Now we know intellectually that that's not actually true. I am much more than my body. I am other than my body. I think we all recognize that as well. But at the same time, we recognize that there's an important identification between the me that exists that transcends the body and this body that I have. And the equation, therefore, means that if I give of my body, I am giving of myself. To give you my body is to give you me. To promise you my body is to promise you me. Then the other component of this is that the relationship between giving the body and promising. We can't help the fact that being sexually intimate with someone is inherently making a kind of promise to them. Now, this is part of my argument. My argument is that's not just a meaning that we impose on the act. That's not just something that culturally we have learned to associate with the act. It is something that is built into the human psyche itself. I can't help myself. I believe that when someone has given me their body, they have made me a promise. And that's the natural language of sexuality. Let me try to illustrate what I'm talking about. You can visualize this scene in a movie where some real jerk of a male human being. Is there any other kind? Where some real jerk has had sex with a woman. It's kind of a one-night stand. And they're sitting in the bed, and he's smoking a cigarette. And this is the movies, right? He's smoking a cigarette, and she reaches over and takes the cigarette to take a puff. And this guy grabs it out of her hand and says, "That's mine." Or make it a sip of Coke or a sip of coffee or something like that. Aren't we astonished at the incongruity between those? I mean, isn't the incongruity just jarring? You've had sex with her and you won't share your Coke? Why is that so jarring to us? I would argue that it's so jarring to us because inherent in the act of sexual intimacy is in fact this promise. Everything that I am, everything that I have, is yours. I am giving you my all, but not my Coke. But I have my limits. You know, I won't let you drink my Coke. The same thing, there's the same incongruity that we all sense when a man will have sex with a woman, but then when she starts asking questions about his life to try to get to know him a little bit, and all of a sudden the boundaries go up and he's closed off, it's none of your damn business, and said in one way or another. And aren't we struck with the incongruity of that? What do you mean? You just told me with your body that everything that you were was mine. I knew your body, but you won't let me know your soul? I mean, notice the euphemism that the Hebrew in the Old Testament uses for sexual intimacy. Adam knew his wife. Now, we all know from experience that people can have sex together and not know each other at all, not give one another knowledge of one another at all. But we also recognize how incongruous that is. Why would you give me your body if you're not going to share your soul with me? It doesn't make any sense, because your body has told me that you are mine and I am yours. There's a great scene in Vanilla Sky. I don't necessarily recommend the movie, but there's this great scene where what's his name? The Tom Cruise character has been having an affair with, I don't even know who it is, but this woman has been having an affair with her, and I don't even know what's happening, but they're it's a great scene. I think they're going to break up, or he's interested in another woman now, and she recognizes that. Well, all along, they've been insisting with one another that this is just for sex. You know, this is just for fun. There's nothing serious here. This is not about a relationship. This is just about physical sex. Well, now he gets interested in another woman, and she's driving the car rather frantically and dangerously, and she says to him, and I don't remember all that she says to him, but basically trots out a litany of their physical intimacy with each other to basically prove to him, you made a promise to me. And I think she even uses that language. You promised me with your body. Something to that effect. Well, I think that's just profoundly accurate. That's exactly the way it is. And that's exactly the way God has designed sexuality, sexual intimacy, designed our psyche. There's also a song, I shouldn't even bring it up because I can't remember, but David Wilcox has a song that somebody shared with me once that's all about this, where it talks about, I think, a one-night encounter or something like that. Maybe I'm wrong about that. But he talks about the, I think he uses the language of your body. Literature, song lyrics have explored this over and over and over again. And I just think it's true of our experience. The objection that somebody would raise would be, but yeah, okay, yes, that's our experience, but that's our culture speaking. You know, it doesn't have to be that way, that's our culture speaking. But now you think of all those other song lyrics and movies and so on that explore over and over and over again the reality of people attempting to divorce sex from relationship, to divorce sex from meaning, and want to have sex without the sex meaning anything, and they cannot do so successfully. Country Western is the best at this. You know, I was at the bar, and I met you at the bar last night, and we decided to go to the motel and have a one-night stand, and so why am I so upset that you left me this morning? Well, you got to get the twang in there. Even when we make a deliberate and purposeful attempt to divorce meaning from sexuality, we can't really do it. Because the meaning is not imposed by me. It's not imposed by culture. It comes from within. It's built into our own psyche. So, why do I believe this is the biblical view? My first argument would be because it seems to be what our experience teaches us is the case. Second thing, and I already suggested this, is that I think biblical sexual ethics makes no sense under any other interpretation. Let's assume a different interpretation. Let's assume that sexual intimacy is only for procreation, for example. That's what it's for. Well, what ethic would follow from the fact that sexual intimacy is for procreation? Basically, the ethic that would follow from that is anyone, anytime, anywhere. Or at least at the most, only one mate at a time until the little ones are raised and gone. At the most. But that's the ethic that would make sense if it was for procreation. What if it's for pleasure? What ethic would follow if the only reason, the only purpose of sexual intimacy is for pleasure? Anyone, anytime, anywhere that I feel like. That would make sense. But that's not the biblical ethic. The biblical ethic is only in the context of a lived out commitment to one another between a man and a woman. And my contention is the biblical ethic makes sense if and only if the purpose of sexual intimacy is to communicate, to ratify, and to celebrate a commitment that two people have to one another. It's the language that God has given us by which we can, in a very dramatic and meaningful and poignant and pleasurable kind of way, celebrate, ratify, confirm, and communicate our lifelong commitment to one another. If that's its purpose, then the biblical sexual ethic makes sense. The only place it's appropriate is in the context of that kind of relationship. If I say with my body, I am yours and you are mine, then I need to live with my life, I am yours and you are mine. And there should be no, it's wrong, it's immoral to allow there to be an incongruity with what I'm saying with my body and how I'm conducting myself in my life. But if that's not enough, then let's look at 1 Corinthians 6, because I think even though Paul doesn't actually spell out his theory, I think implicit in what Paul is saying in 1 Corinthians 6 is exactly this theory of sexuality. I'm in 6, 12 through 20. I'm going to work from my own translation here. And if you have another translation that you're looking at and have a question about why I translated it, then feel free to ask me. But I'm going to work from my translation here. All things are lawful for me, but not all things are of benefit. All things are lawful for me, but I will not be mastered by anything. Food is for the stomach, and the stomach is for food. And in the end, God will do away with both the one and the other. But the body is not for immorality. Rather, it is for the Lord, and the Lord is for the body. Now, God has not only raised up the Lord, but he shall also raise us up through his power. Do you not understand that your bodies are members that belong to the Messiah? Shall I then take members belonging to the Messiah and make them members promised to a prostitute? Of course not. Or do you not understand, perhaps, that the one who clings to a prostitute is one in body with her? It says, the two shall become one flesh. But the one who clings to the Lord is one in spirit with him. Flee from fornication. Every sin that a man might commit is a sin apart from the body. But the one who commits fornication commits a sin within his own body. Or do you perhaps not understand that your body is a temple of that Holy Spirit within you that you have from God? Indeed, you are not your own. You have been bought with a price. Accordingly, glorify God in your body. The Corinthians were affected by a lot of different perspectives and attitudes and philosophies that were current in Corinth in that day. And he starts this thing by responding to, I think, a position that some among the Corinthians had taken and were arguing. They, first of all, they're taking the slogan, all things are lawful for me. And I think Paul is quoting them when he says that, all things are lawful for me. I think he's quoting them because that's their contention. All things are lawful for me. He says, all things are lawful for me. That's true, but not all things are of benefit. I think we misunderstand what Paul is saying there because it's easy to misunderstand what he's saying there. Because when he says not all things are of benefit, he he means with respect to salvation, with respect to eternal life. He means really of ultimate benefit. It may be true that not all things are lawful for me, but some things damn me. And I need to avoid things that damn me, basically. He's willing to grant that all things are lawful for me in a sense, rightly understood. And I must confess, I'm not altogether sure where that slogan is coming from. And I think if we understood the context of where that slogan is coming from, we would understand better why Paul is willing to grant some credence to that. On the surface, it's not obviously true. All things are lawful for me. But there's some context behind that. It probably has to do with these Gentiles who are saying, look, we're no longer, salvation is no longer a matter of keeping the Mosaic law, keeping the Mosaic covenant, something, the dietary regulations and all this religion, ritual and stuff, and all things now are lawful for me. Well, Paul is a teacher of that. Paul is a proponent of that perspective, that salvation is not really about meticulous covenant keeping, it's about something else. So rather than get into this protracted argument and writing the book of Romans all over again to try to respond to that, I think what he's saying, he's giving a nod to that. Well, okay, rightly understood, yeah, there's a sense in which I have myself taught that all things are lawful for me. There's a sense in which that's true. But however much there might be a sense in which that's true, I would maintain that not all things are a benefit. And what he means is morally and spiritually. Some things are morally and spiritually deadly. And he's going to argue fornication is one of those. So all things are lawful for me, but not all things are a benefit. All things are lawful for me, but I will not be mastered by anything, he says. Now he quotes the Corinthians again, I think. Food is for the stomach, and the stomach is for food, and in the end, God will do away with both the one and the other. Their position seems to be, look, sex is just natural, Paul. Dogs do it. All kinds of animals do it. We human beings do it. It's instinctual. It's just a part of what God created us to be. You know, relax. Don't tense up. Don't be uptight. Just allow sex to be sex. In the end, we're all going to die and our bodies are going to turn to dust and there won't be sex anymore. God's going to do away with the stomach and food, and we are one day going to be spiritual beings who don't need to eat. One day it's true we won't have sex either because we will be rid of our physical bodies. But in the meantime, Paul, we are physical beings, and a natural part of being a physical being is sex. So being a part of our natural physical being, it's not subject to moral judgment. It's not subject to moral restraints. It is really a non-moral issue whether we have sex or not. So that, I think, is their argument to which he wants to respond. So food is for the stomach and the stomach is for food, and in the end, God will do away with both the one and the other. The point is they're making an analogy between eating and sex. Sex is just as natural as eating. Paul's response, but the body is not for immorality. Rather, it is for the Lord, and the Lord is for the body. Now, God has not only raised up the Lord, but he shall also raise us up through his power. And he refers to the resurrection, and part of what he's saying is, in the end, we're not disembodied spirits. At the end of all things, we are given a new body, and we will be embodied creatures in the end just as surely as we are now. Different body, different physicality, different attributes perhaps, but it is still nonetheless embodied. And in our embodied state in the end, we will have to serve the Lord with that body to be righteous, to be good, to be obedient, to be faithful servants. We will need to serve the Lord with those bodies that we are given. Well, just as that's true in the end after the resurrection, it's likewise true right now. What I need to do is serve the Lord with my body. The body is not for immorality, the body is for the Lord, is what he says, and the Lord is for the body. My body is to be used to serve the Lord, and the Lord is committed to saving me, an embodied creature. So basically he's calling into question their analogy. He's saying, just because something pertains to my physical body doesn't mean that it doesn't have a moral aspect or a moral dimension to it. There are all kinds of physical things that I need to do that are subject to moral restraints and that are subject to moral criticism, because it's with the body that I either serve the Lord or don't serve the Lord, obey him or don't obey him. He's going to return to that in the next paragraph. But before he does that, he introduces a new subject, and that is, I think, what pertains to the subject tonight. What is really the meaning and purpose of sexuality? He says, "Do you not understand that your bodies are members that belong to the Messiah? Shall I then take members belonging to the Messiah and make them members promised to a prostitute? Of course not. Or do you not understand, perhaps, that the one who clings to a prostitute is one in body with her? It says, the two shall become one flesh. But the one who clings to the Lord is one in spirit with him." And I'll finish that here in a second. Okay, what is his argument? What was striking to me the first time I studied this passage is he quotes the Genesis passage, the two will become one flesh. And as we saw when we looked at that passage earlier this quarter, that's not about sex. That's about marriage. The two becoming one flesh is the nature of the marriage relationship, that the purpose for God even creating a difference in the sexes at all is so that man and woman could enter into a marriage relationship to one another, and that marriage relationship is defined as becoming one flesh. So why would Paul respond to your being joined physically in a physical act of sexual intimacy with a prostitute and see a passage in the Old Testament speaking of marriage as having any relevance to that? What's the connection? Well, the connection, I think, is he's saying, of course, don't you understand that the one who clings to a prostitute is one in body with her? It's very cryptic. It's difficult to know exactly what he means, but I think the only way you can make sense out of this passage is to realize that he's saying what that woman said to Tom Cruise in the car. But your body promised me. And Paul is saying, don't you understand that when you go and are joined to a prostitute, that your body is saying something to the prostitute? Namely, you're promising to be one with her? And that's why he can appropriately quote the Genesis thing. Doesn't it say the two shall become one flesh, which pertains to a lifetime commitment of marriage, because he sees the act of sexual intimacy, the giving of my body, as actually making that promise, making that claim. I will be one with you. And so he's, don't you understand that? That you, when you go and sleep with a prostitute, it's not a meaningless act. It's not just like eating. It's not just a bodily function. It's an actual communication with another human being. And you are saying to that other human being, I will be one with you. I am making a marriage-like commitment to you. I'm promising you that kind of relationship. And then he points out the incongruity with that. But the one who clings to the Lord is one in spirit with him. Now, why is that relevant? Most people look at this passage, it's so cryptic that they're thinking in terms of these weird metaphysics. You know, that you, in sex, you become metaphysically one with a prostitute, but you've already been metaphysically one with the Lord, and I don't know what you're supposed to conclude from that, but Jesus doesn't like prostitutes, so don't be making him one with prostitutes. I mean, I don't know what we're supposed to do with that, but there's just this weird, mind-warping kinds of perspective that we take on this. He's not doing metaphysics here at all. What he's saying is very, very sensible and very commonsensical. What he's saying is, you are one with the Lord in spirit. That is, Jesus values what Jesus taught you to be important and to be valuable is what you have embraced with your heart. And what have you embraced with your heart? I mean, what has the Lord taught you? That you should love one another. That you should be a person of integrity. That you should be honest. That you should be straightforward. Jesus himself said, let your yes be yes and your no be no, as part of the integrity that he said we as human beings should have. If in my spirit I have embraced the value of letting my yes be yes and my no be no, And then with my body, I'm lying to this prostitute. Sure, I'll be one with you tonight. Until I decide otherwise. How is your yes being yes and your no being no something that you're committed to in your heart and your spirit because you are a disciple of Jesus on the one hand, when with your body you're quite willing to lie to this woman, to this prostitute? He's saying those don't go together. That doesn't make any sense. That's this incredible hypocrisy. So when we understand the meaning of sexuality, we realize how incredibly morally impossible it is for us to be fornicators. Because fornication is a big, huge deception and a lie. I'm saying something with my body that I am not prepared to follow through with in the rest of my life. And if I'm not prepared to do it, then why am I making a promise that I have no intention of keeping? So he says at the end of that section, flee from fornication. And then this next one is difficult, but I think I see what he's saying here. Every sin that a man might commit is a sin apart from or outside the body. Now, why is he saying that? I think he's saying that because he's hearkening back to the argument that these people were making who were saying that fornication is not a moral issue. They have another set of opponents in Corinth. Part of the Greek culture is that anything material and physical is inherently defiled and defiling. So their perspective would be that sex is just wrong because it's yucky. You know, sex is wrong because it's physical. Sex is wrong because it's sex. And there would be a whole component in Corinth who would take that position. And we see that later in the book of Corinthians. He spends a whole two chapters trying to tell people, if you're married, it's really okay to have sex. It's not against spirituality for you to be sexual with one another as husband and wife. And he has to spend two chapters fighting that battle. So we know that that's a serious issue in Corinth. This other group of people in Corinth is rejecting that. And they're saying, look, we don't think there's anything wrong with stuff that's physical. We eat, and that's not defiling. We have to eat. Just natural, just God made us material physical beings, and it's okay to eat food, and it's okay to have sex. So what Paul is saying here then is every sin that a man might commit is a sin apart from the body, and I think what he means by that in this context is apart from its physicality, apart from its sexuality. That is to say, if we commit a sin, it is never the case that a sin is sinful because it's physical. An action is sinful because it's physical. It's never the case that an action is wrong because it has to do with our bodies. He rejects that. And I think that in this statement he's rejecting that. I'm not arguing that fornication is sinful because it's physical. I'm not arguing that fornication is sinful because it's sexual. There's nothing wrong with sex. I grant you that. I agree with you in that regard. But, he goes on to say, the one who commits fornication commits a sin within his own body. That is to say, sex is not wrong because it's sex, but sex can be wrong for other reasons. And that's exactly what he's argued here. Why is fornication with a prostitute wrong? Because I've been lying, is why. It's deceitful. It's not having my yes be yes and my no be no. It's not straightforward. There's no integrity in the act. That's why it's wrong. Put it in another context. Put it in the context of marriage, where I'm not lying with my body. I am intending to follow through in the rest of my life with what my body is saying. And the physicality of sex, the sexuality of sex, is not a problem at all in that context. But just because sex is not wrong because it's physical doesn't mean it's never wrong. There are contexts in which it's sinful, immoral, inappropriate, when I'm lying and deceiving with my body. And then the last point is not really relevant to our topic here tonight. Do you perhaps not understand that your body is a temple of that Holy Spirit within you that you have from God? We've already made the same point, namely, I can't love you by just talking about loving you. I must act, and I must employ my body in certain actions to do that. So my body is the temple of that set of commitments within me that I share with my Lord Jesus. And it's in my body that I give that I manifest concretely what my commitments are. Okay, I think that's enough. I'll open it up for your questions or comments or discussion.
This is kind of out from left field here. I know that from previous discussions, you have said that that Paul has referred to the body to the Corinthians as being the group of people that are in the church in Corinth, correct?
In some context.
Mm-hmm. So could you differentiate for me the context here between, you know, I'm having trouble, maybe it's just because I'm hazy from other context, but I'm having a little trouble separating this from the other times when it's not this way.
I'm not sure how to answer that. I mean, I can answer that, but it's not going to be a very satisfying answer. I think if we just pay close enough attention to each individual context and what the issues are, what the question is, and what his argument is in response, that's what... I mean, I've actually tried to look at this passage. Maybe by the body he means the body of believers, the church, the assembly, like he does in other places, but I can't make this passage work that way. And on the other hand, it makes perfectly good sense in the context of sharing your body with someone for him to really literally be talking about my physical body. That makes a lot of sense then to see that as the point under discussion. Now, are you talking specifically about your body as the temple of the Holy Spirit? Is that the one you're referring to?
Yeah.
Okay.
So.
Yeah. Yeah, that's especially interesting because in chapter 3, where he says, how's he put it? You, he doesn't say your body, but he says you are the temple of the Holy Spirit, you plural. There he is talking about the Corinthian believers as a body of believers, as a group of believers, and that is exactly what he means there. But the way you know that is by the nature of the argument and the context. He's just using a different metaphor in chapter 3 from chapter 6.
What about something like pornography? With your definition, is it wrong because it's also communicating a lie or because some other reason?
No, that's different. I'll talk about that next week. Next week we're going to talk about sexual ethics. And I would argue that this is only one of the pillars of the biblical sexual ethics. And there's two or three more. I don't remember how many, but there's two or three more that go into defining all the ways the Bible talks about what it means to be righteous sexually. And this is only one of them. Yeah, in the case of pornography, I don't really think that's what's going on. Can you wait till next week?
Sure.
Okay.
I was wondering, so then what would be the case of someone who have sex before marriage but are intending to marry after that? What's the morality behind that?
Well, it would be inappropriate because, if I'm understanding this right, the purpose of sexual intimacy is to celebrate, communicate, and ratify something that I am in a position to act on and act on now. Namely, the fact of the matter is, we can talk about how marriage is just a piece of paper or something like that, but it's not the piece of paper that makes marriage marriage. I mean, no one really cares about the piece of paper. But what we do care about is that every public institution in this society knows where I stand with respect to this woman. And so all the piece of paper represents is the voice of the larger culture, the public, where I have been able, in an effective way, to say to that public, we are committed to one another for the rest of our lives. Well, now that's a reality that we can celebrate. That's a reality that I am acting on, I have acted on, and can continue to act on. Until that has been made clear, has been effectively communicated to my culture, however my culture gets that communicated, until that has happened, then I'm not really being straightforward, because I'm saying with my body what I am not yet in a position to carry out with my life. Now, that can get tricky, because there are different subcultures. Back when I was first married, I had a Bible study up on a hippie commune in the Santa Cruz Mountains. And there were a number of the hippies up there were actually, I think, Christians. Most of them were not, but a number of them were. And there was one couple in particular who, I mean, basically on this hippie commune, the sexual mores were you slept with whoever you wanted to sleep with whenever you wanted to. I mean, they're just swapped partners like crazy all the time. But there's one couple that no one would have ever dreamt of approaching them to swap partners with them, because they were together. I mean, they basically, people saw them the way anybody in straight society would have seen husband and wife. They were Christians. This couple were Christians. Now, they were not legally married. They had got married by going out on the point, looking over the Pacific Ocean and pledging their lives to one another. I mean, that was their marriage. Now, they at one point came and asked me, she got pregnant, and they came to me and asked me if I would perform a ceremony to make them legally married. Well, I happened to be working at a church at that time where the policy was, if two people who are living together ask to be married, then the policy is you are to ask them to separate until the wedding. And I'm not sure anymore that I understand the rationale behind that. I don't even know if I agree with the rationale behind that, but that was the policy that this church practiced. So I had a real dilemma here that I had to face, because on the one hand, I understood how they were perceived in their relevant community. Now, I say their relevant community, that I think there was a larger relevant community, and that's why they finally felt the need to be married. Because as much as we hippies didn't like the establishment, it was a whole lot more powerful than we were. And there are all kinds of issues, economic issues, legal issues, inheritance issues, all kinds of issues that could only be resolved by a legal relationship, a legal marriage. And that's what they sensed, and that's what they faced with the coming of a child into the world, and that's why they wanted to be married now. Well, I have this dilemma. Does it really make any sense for these people that are as married as my wife and I are in the eyes of their community to ask them to separate before the ceremony? And I finally resolved it in my own mind that although they weren't completely married, they were nonetheless authentically married, because they had communicated somehow in a way that was relevant to their community. They had communicated to the community that we're together, we're one. We're in this for keeps. Well, that's what a marriage is. And that's the more important piece that makes a marriage than even the legal reality. But it was incomplete, because, in effect, this man was in a situation where everything I have is mine except what the laws of this land won't allow me to give to you because we're not legally married, or whatever the case may be. To not be legally one is to be not completely and totally one. And so I'm really not celebrating a reality in sexual intimacy if I haven't made myself completely and totally one with my wife.
You've been talking mostly about when you take sexuality outside of marriage, the problems that causes. But you touched on it a little bit, talking about that passage in Corinthians, about within marriage, what the ethics are there. I know I tend to tell myself the story that, you know, when I'm married, all the conflicts will be resolved. You know, everything will be taken care of. But I can't imagine that, you know, with all of the baggage that people tend to bring, you know, that you're going to have it all figured out within marriage. And so can you talk a little bit about...
And what's the context in your question, that baggage with respect to...
Well, their sexuality.
Sexuality?
Right.
Okay.
I mean, how... I know that the focus of your talk was different, but could you talk about sexuality within marriage. And
okay. Well, I'll have somebody at least will be talking on that subject later in the course, so that they can deal with it more thoroughly. Well, there are a lot of attitudes that we can take towards sexuality that, along the lines of what the Corinthians faced, that we just need to get rid of. And there comes a point where we have to believe what's true rather than what feels true to us. So, for example, if people have been trained to believe that sex is dirty and that sex is somehow inherently defiling, there's nothing right about maintaining that attitude or persisting in that attitude, because it's wrong. That's an unbiblical and an untrue perspective. So, to whatever extent that's part of the baggage, I think in obedience to our Lord, we need to allow ourselves to be persuaded out of that perspective. That can be easier said than done. I mean, that can be a really, really difficult problem. If I have the attitude that sex just is an animal act, a bestial act, I need to get a different perspective on that. I need to understand that that's not right. I need to understand that this is a dance between two people that has meaning. A big one that we men face is marriage. We can have the perspective that marriage is a time where I get sex on demand. Well, that ain't true. I need to be patient and self-restrained and loving and kind. I need to read the situation and read the circumstances just as much after marriage as I did before marriage. It's not a time of sexual license. It's a time where sex is now appropriate within marriage, but it's not something that I can have whenever I want it. I need to be loving. I need to be kind. I need to exercise all of the integrity that any single person needs to exercise.
So, let me see if I can paraphrase what you're saying with my own twist. Confusion in sexuality is given. It seems.
Yes.
I mean, you aren't born with a comprehensive understanding of what's right. And marriage, I mean, having a marriage doesn't automatically baptize my sexuality.
Right. Right.
But it's there where I finally begin to work out what is appropriate for the
right
expression of that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure we'll talk more about this, but we live in a society that has completely lost sight of the purpose of sexuality, and we see it as nothing but animal pleasure. And we are sophisticated people who can become gourmet experts at sexual pleasure, at the animal, at the physical pleasure. And so it's very easy to sort of adopt the attitude that anything goes in sexuality. What we're going for is the ultimate orgasm. That's what we're going for in sexuality. And so we as Christians, we recognize that you can only do it in marriage, but within the context of marriage, my sexuality is to try to go for the ultimate orgasm. I mean, it's easy to have that perspective in our society. Well, the people who are going for the ultimate orgasm are going to have a lot better sex life than I will, because they have made that the end and the goal of their existence, to their shame, to their degradation, and to the undying testimony to how shallow they are. I mean, that they've made that the sum and substance of their existence. But do they have better sex physically? Maybe, sometimes. Okay? But it's meaningless sex. It's hollow sex. It's empty sex. So one of the things that we, as when we get married in our culture, are going to face, one of the problems that we need to confront, is the difference between sexuality in my marriage and what sexuality is in our culture. I mean, if you have If you have any exposure to pornography, or if you've studied pornography or know anything about pornography, it's just like drugs. It has to get kinkier and kinkier and kinkier and kinkier to be interesting. Well, obviously, there's something distorted and perverse about that. The purpose of sex is not to give me an adrenaline rush. It's to be this language that we use to communicate with each other. And so, in the context of marriage, sex can be very quiet and lacking in passion, or wild and passionate on another occasion. It's going to be varied as the circumstances vary, as the moods vary, as the stages of life vary. I mean, there's going to be all kinds of various experiences physically that are happening within the sexual relationship, but it's always meaningful. What the constant within sex in marriage is the meaning of it, the purpose of it, and what it communicates and what it accomplishes in the marriage, even while the experience itself may be very, very variable.
I've heard you talk about sensuality before, and what the Bible means by sensuality. Could you say something about the difference between living for sensual pleasure and just enjoying our bodies and our senses, and what that is about?
Okay. Probably the place where that distinction was most poignantly made was in, have you read Perelandra by C.S. Lewis? Remember the green lady, there's a bubble tree? And the bubble tree grows these little bubble fruits, and when they burst, this mist or something comes over a person, and if it comes over you, you get some kind of euphoric feeling or something like that. And I think it's I may be making this part up, but I think it's the unman suggests to her that maybe it would be a good idea for her to store up those bubble fruits. Am I making this up, or is this to store them up? And that way, whenever she wants to, she can burst a bubble fruit over her and get that euphoric feeling. And the green lady's response is, well, why would I want to do that? I mean, one, it's a beautiful image of innocence on the one hand, but it makes the distinction, I think, between sensuality and being sensual. There's nothing wrong with serendipitously having the experience of the pleasure that comes from having that bubble fruit burst over the top of you, but to insist on having it, not as a gift from God, but as something I want because I want it and I want it now, that's to be given over to the experience of my senses in a way that doesn't take into account the purpose of my existence. It's not the purpose of my existence to have pleasurable sense experience. It's part of God's creation that I have pleasurable sense experience. It will happen. It will happen as a gift from God, serendipitously. But for me to insist on it, or go after it, or to make it my goal, or to make it my objective to have pleasurable sense experience, that's a perversion of who I am. And that's what I think the Bible calls sensuality. And it's not just sex. It can be food. It could be sleep. You know, any aspect of our physical existence that we insist on and must have. And the fact that sometimes people just refuse to be uncomfortable, well, sometimes discomfort happens. And for me to insist on not being uncomfortable is a form of sensuality, I think.
You've defined, sexuality as a language which shows one's commitment to another. On the basis of that ethic, it doesn't seem that prohibits necessarily sexuality between like men and men or homosexuality. So right. How does that, you know, where does that ethic come in a biblical perspective?
Okay, I've been using the word commitment, but when I use the word commitment, what I really meant is a marriage commitment. So the sex between women and women and men would be ruled out, because in the biblical view of marriage, there can be no such thing really as a marriage commitment, a valid, appropriate marriage commitment between a man and a man, and a woman and a woman. So I was just using commitment as a shorthand for a marriage commitment, and we need to allow the Bible to define marriage for us. And the Bible defines marriage as a commitment between two people who are radically and fundamentally different as male and female.
Tagging on to the end of that question,
mm-hmm.
I'm trying to figure out, like, within a marriage, where, like, is the language of commitment the same for, like, Christians and non-Christians?
I think so, yeah.
But I'm not talking about necessarily the nature of sex, but the actual, like, the communication between the two people.
Okay, help me know what
well,
you mean
by that.
Well,
I'm thinking about, like, what you talk about when you say koinonia. You know?
Okay.
Like a commonality and purpose towards God or something like that, that it seems like sex would be like a tool to communicate something like that in the physical. Does that make sense? Where, I mean, in a sense, it helps me rule out certain things like homosexuality and some of these, like, these sex in a non-valid relationship. Because in relation to something like koinonia.
Oh, I see. Well, I'm not sure I've thought deeply enough about this to answer that question. Sexuality is a natural language, but I think it's a relatively blunt instrument of communication. That is, I don't know how specifically or acutely or in that what depth of detail it's able to communicate. So I kind of doubt if it can communicate in such a way that it can communicate the different level of commonality that two believers have with one another versus two unbelievers. I shouldn't think so. But I probably need to think about that some more. What I was answering at first is that I think it's just a human language. So whether we're believers or not believers, I think we infer the same things from sexual intimacy. And that's why there's so much jealousy on the Jerry Springer Show. Just this hatred, this rage, because, you know, people have been saying stuff with their bodies, and people are outraged that they're not following through on what they said with their bodies.
So does it communicate commitment, but a non-Christian commitment, just a pure commitment, without any strings attached of godliness?
Right.
Okay, so it's just a human language.
I think so. Right. Now, the reason I hesitated there is it's what it's communicating, though, is a permanent commitment, a promise for keeps. And that's, of course, what our culture is trying to deny and trying to run from. That this is all fine and good for now, but let's not take this too seriously. And that's why we keep, you know, you keep seeing this scenario played out in all of your movies and in the literature, is we're trying to find a way to have sex without it being what they call complicated. And what they mean by complicated is, I want to have sex, but I don't want it to have any sort of meaning in terms of my relationship with the person. I don't want it to put any obligations on me relationally. Well, we can't do that. Sex always, by its very nature, gets complicated because it is communicating a promise that I'm going to relate to you in a certain way, and we can't help ourselves. We know that that's what it means. So it's a truth that we Christians acknowledge and embrace and we recognize, and so it's a Christian truth that's being communicated by sex, but I think it gets communicated just by virtue of the fact that we're human beings. We don't have to be believers that acknowledge it in theory in order for us to hear the language of our bodies in practice.
Just continuing on with what you just said, would you call that an instinct, the way Marlon Perkins and Wild Kingdom may? I mean, about the communication. I really dated myself.
Well, I don't think so. I don't think so, just because that instincts don't have meaning. They're just rote behavior, I think. I mean, maybe I've never been a bee, so yeah. But I don't think that they are. I don't think they are interpreting or reading or making judgments or understanding anything. They're just doing what bees do and just doing what dogs do and just doing what dolphins do. Whereas we as human beings are actually making judgments. We're rational beings. So we're actually reading and understanding and interpreting a language, I think.
But that's the part that I was wondering is, since everybody knows what you're talking about when you say you feel the promise, even though some people in today's world may want to brutalize themselves, their psyche away from, you've said this before, away from reading each other, that reading is the part I'm wondering if you would call that inherent in humanity.
Yes.
I mean, you've said that online,
but I'm
wondering if
I think it's innate. I was just balking at the word instinct. But yes, like an instinct, I think it is inherent. I think it is innate within the human psyche. Yeah.
Like the will to live?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
What does that say for people who regularly go out on one-night stands, a male who may take a different person each night?
Yeah.
What does that imply about them?
Brian alluded to this. What I've argued in the past is that we human beings are pretty plastic. We're pretty malleable. We're pretty moldable. We can be shaped. Our attitudes can be shaped. What God has put there, we can take away. So I think it is possible for us to beat the meaning of our sexuality out of ourselves, to so brutalize our own psyche that we no longer feel the connection. Sex can just be sex. So if you want it as your ambition to separate sex from meaning, you can probably succeed if you want to. But at what cost? You know, what are we doing to ourselves when we do that? I would argue that we are brutalizing ourselves and bestializing ourselves. We're turning ourselves into dogs, into animals. And if we want that as our ambition, I suppose, okay, we can get there. But we, of Christians of all people, should at that point go, why? Why would I want to do that? That the scene in Sodom is just chilling to me, where the angels strike the men blind, but they are so obsessed with having sex with these strangers that they, even being blind, are scraping, scratching at the door to try to get in. I mean, Paul starts off this section, all things are lawful, but I will not be mastered by anything. Well, to make it our ambition to become so sexual that sex takes over and becomes an irresistible drive in me that I can't control, that's an ambition. And yet that's where these men in Sodom were at. It's just it's a very ugly picture, it seems to me, a very chilling picture. But it seems to me that's where our culture is going these days. That's what we have made it our ambition to become as bestial and animal-like as we can in the way we experience our sexuality.
Jack, could it be possible to look at it another way, that perhaps people are looking for that kind of connection, but they're just too lazy to live it out with their lives, and they experience it in sex, they experience it as, this is somebody valuing me, this is a valid, valuable experience, I feel a oneness, I don't have time to do it in any other part of my life, but I feel it here in this experience, so I'll just take it in sex, and I'll forget life, and I'll just grab it this way, as opposed to, they're separating it there, and so in a sense it's kind of could be a sad state of affairs that they're going for that, but they're only getting, they're not getting the life part, they're not getting the soul part, they're just getting the body part.
Well, that's a different phenomenon, but that's equally prevalent, and probably is more old-fashioned. I mean, I think our culture is headed away from that, but that back in the hippie days, that was very prevalent. All kinds of song lyrics about that. Tell me lies, tell me sweet little lies. You know, that's what that's all about. I mean, you don't need to mean anything, you don't need to be committed to me, but let me for tonight feel like you're committed to me. Because, I mean, at least let me have the feeling. Another song about that. But, that's exactly right. That one of the things that's interesting, this relational connection, this being talked to with somebody's body, is the much more meaningful part of sexual intimacy. Otherwise, we'd have, you know, some CEO of some company that builds sex machines that gives you the ultimate orgasm. But somehow, I mean, Paul Simon wrote a song about that, right? The big green, whatever it is, pleasure machine. I've read serious philosophical arguments about that. Philosophers wondering, why is it that that a pleasure machine, an orgasm machine, wouldn't be just as interesting to us as another human being? Why is that? What is it? Well, I think the Bible has an answer for that. Because the much more interesting and satisfying aspect of sexual intimacy is not the physical pleasure. As interesting as and as compelling as that can be, that's not the most interesting thing. The most interesting thing is having someone talk to me with their body and the emotional, psychological pleasure that comes from having made a promise to me. And so, yeah, absolutely. If I can't have a relationship, at least I can, for tonight, feel like I have a relationship with somebody, and that's interesting. Or did I miss your point? I mean, yeah, okay. You need to study your rock and roll. There's a lot of,
good stuff. You need to memorize some lyrics.
Yeah. Okay.